Welcome to Rapid Clinical Case Review, as our faculty provide perspectives on actual cases of metastatic urothelial bladder cancer, Issue 1. I'm medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, Dr. Catherine Fahey from the Lindberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Dr. Fern Anari from the Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, present real cases of metastatic bladder cancer from their practices. And following these presentations, Dr. Matt Golsky from the Tisch Cancer Institute in New York, New York, will provide commentary. To begin, the first case is presented by Dr. Fahey.
62-year-old man. He came into the emergency room with gross hematuria. During his history there, he reports that he's lost 40 pounds over the last few months. They do get a CT scan in the emergency room, and this shows a large bladder mass, some mesenteric adenopathy, some mild left hadronephrosis, cystoscopy into URBT, which revealed a large left-sided bladder mass. His final path shows a high-grade urothelial carcinoma with extensive invasion into the muscle layer. We got a PET scan, which showed those lymph nodes that were present on the CT had extensive FDG uptake. There was also uptake in a few of the bones as well. We started him on treatment with enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab, and he had a very impressive response.
So what's his current status?
I actually just saw him in clinic last week. He has finished his 7th cycle of EVP. He has gained weight. He's not going to the bathroom at night anymore. He's had a couple of toxicities, but is overall tolerated therapy pretty well. He, as people who give a lot of EV know, they can really get some interesting rashes with enfortumab vedotin. So he had a very dry, flaking rash that was kind of diffuse all over his body. There was some mild pruritus with it. He didn't have any sort of erythema, raised skin. There was no peeling, but it was somewhat bothersome to him. That responded pretty well to Benadryl treatment and topical steroids. But other than that, he's actually really tolerated therapy quite well. I think some good discussion points would be, how quickly do you typically see a response to treatment when you're giving enfortumab vedotin? This gentleman is someone who had an excellent response after just 9 weeks of treatment. How dramatic of a response do you usually see? How long are you continuing enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab? Is there a set time point where you stop one or both drugs? Are there particular toxicities that lead to you dropping a drug at a particular time point? Is there any sort of monitoring that you are using to determine when a patient can safely stop one of these medications, or are you trying to continue for as many doses as possible for as long as possible? For the faculty, what is the typical duration of response that you are seeing for patients when you treat them on EV? Another question would be, when his disease progresses, what would you choose as a second-line therapy, assuming that he doesn't have any targeted options that we tend to use to direct therapy?
Dr. Fahey presents a patient who was diagnosed with metastatic urothelial cancer, who had not previously received treatment, and treatment with enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab was recommended. The patient had a significant response to treatment, continued treatment for some duration, without the development of treatment-limiting toxicities, developed what seems to be, you know, a grade 1 to 2 rash that was managed with supportive care. So EV pembro, certainly the standard first-line treatment for metastatic urothelial cancer now based on the EV-302 study showing that that regimen led to higher response rates, higher event-free survival, and a higher overall survival compared to platinum-based chemotherapy. The response rates with EV pembro, about 67%, with about 30% of patients having a complete response. And so this lines up with expectations. In that study, treatment with EV was given as long as it was being tolerated and as long as it was conferring benefit. And treatment with pembrolizumab was capped at about 2 years, somewhat arbitrary. In real-world clinical practice, there are often reasons why we discontinue one or the other drug sooner, but that's how it was done in the study. Rash is a common side effect, a potential side effect of both drugs. Rash with EV is most often common, but not treatment-limiting. there are a subset of individuals who have more serious rashes. As we know from other drugs that cause rash, grading of rash is based on the degree of surface area involved, most commonly managed with EV, with topical steroids. That's probably the most common intervention for rash.
A couple of related questions. One, just in terms of the decision about to use EV Pembro as first-line therapy, any relative or absolute contraindications, particularly as it relates to IO?
So certainly contraindications to IO would be contraindications to EV Pembro, and those don't come up so commonly. And of course, some of those are more absolute and some of them are more relative. Some of them are more relative based on the fact that those patients were excluded from the clinical trials that led to the approvals. But of course, we have some anecdotal data in patients who have been treated with autoimmune conditions showing that in certain circumstances, maybe the benefit does outweigh the potential risk. Regarding EV, there are some contraindications or relative contraindications to EV as well, although not too many of those. Patients with very severe neuropathy, you might want to consult about the risks versus the benefits. Patients with a hemoglobin of A1C above 8% were excluded from the clinical trials involving EV. Whether or not those patients need to be excluded from treatment or whether or not they could have their diabetes managed more aggressively prior to considering starting treatment, of course, depends on some personal trade-offs regarding risk versus benefit.
This safe patient actually had a very good response at the first imaging at 3 months. Typically, do you see quick responses with EV Pembro?
The images show dramatic responses. This is, again, in line with what many patients fortunately experience with EV Pembro. Response rate is 67%, complete response rate of 30%. The responses tend to happen quickly. The median time to response is about 2 months with EV Pembro. That's oftentimes, I think, confused with the median time to maximal response, which is different. So we often see responses very quickly, but responses in addition evolve over time. And so you might not see that maximum benefit on the first scan, but you tend to see a benefit by the first scan.
You know, kind of thinking about kind of what a waterfall plot looks like with this, how often do you see people actually progress right through EV Pembro?
So it happens in a minority of patients, but there's probably about 15 to 20% of patients who have primary refractory disease.
So one other question, which is, of course, this patient had no prior systemic therapy, but it seems like we maybe are going to get a new generation of patients who've had prior actually EV Pembro neoadjuvantly. How are you going to think about EV Pembro or first-line therapy for metastatic disease if a patient relapses after prior neoadjuvant EV Pembro? And are you using EV Pembro neoadjuvantly?
So EV Pembro in the neoadjuvant or perioperative setting, certainly approved now for patients who are cisplatin ineligible based on the KEYNOTE 905 study. That study included both a neoadjuvant and an adjuvant portion. And I think decisions on what to do in patients who have disease recurrence after receiving perioperative EV Pembro depends a bit on the details, including how it was administered in the perioperative setting. So say someone gets 3 cycles of neoadjuvant therapy, then has surgery and doesn't get any adjuvant therapy and has metastatic progression a year later, that's someone who I would probably consider treating again. Someone who develops metastatic disease while on the adjuvant portion of EV Pembro, that's probably someone who I'm going to recommend switches to a different mechanism of action.
The next case is presented by Dr. Onari.
This is an 82-year-old female who was initially diagnosed with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, who then developed metastatic disease. She had next generation sequencing at that time that revealed she was TMB high. At that point, I discussed with her the use of platinum-based chemotherapy. She declined the use of chemotherapy due to her advanced age, but was willing to move forward with single agent pembrolizumab. She started single agent pembrolizumab in April of 21. Her initial CT scan in June of 21 showed a substantial decrease in her lymph node disease with resolution of most lesions, as well as resolution of her prominent right lower lobe nodules. She was then transitioned to pembrolizumab 400 milligrams every 6 weeks. When she came in December of 2021 to review a restaging scan, she was found to have new patchy ground glass and consolidative opacities in the lungs consistent with pneumonitis, as well as treatment response. The patient was asymptomatic. Her oxygen saturation in the office was 97%. She had had history of being on steroids and was hesitant to go on anything, so she was started on Omedrol dose pack. Follow-up CT scan 1 month later showed that the pneumonitis had progressed. At that point, she agreed to treatment with prednisone 1 milligram per kilogram daily, which was tapered over 3 weeks. Her next follow-up CT scan showed overall improvement in her pneumonitis with two new areas. So she was referred to pulmonary. Our pulmonary specialist felt that she had grade 1 pneumonitis that was asymptomatic, and they recommended against further treatment. Since that time, she's been on observation off of all treatment and has no evidence of active malignancy since 2021. Some questions I pose to you are, how would you plan to image a patient with immune-mediated complication from a checkpoint inhibitor who has a complete response and no evidence of active disease? Would you utilize cell-free DNA in this case, along with imaging? How do you counsel patients who've had an immune-mediated adverse event and have reservations about not receiving further immunotherapy? This patient in particular was nervous about discontinuing her treatment, but given her older age, and she was living independently at home, we opted to stop the pembrolizumab, even though she was asymptomatic. And thankfully, she's had no evidence of disease over the last 4 years.
This is an individual with metastatic urothelial cancer who has multiple comorbidities and for whom the risks versus benefits of EV pembro were not felt to present a favorable balance. Single agent immune checkpoint blockade we know has a track record in urothelial cancer, and of course there were randomized studies that looked at single agent therapy versus chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint blockade versus chemotherapy alone, and the way that those studies were designed made asking and answering the single agent immunotherapy question a little bit challenging. That said, we do know it has single agent activity, and depending on the study, 20 to 30% of patients will have a response to single agent immune checkpoint blockade. And when those responses occur, of course, they can be quite durable. So the challenge with first line therapy is really understanding or trying to understand which patients are the ones who could have a high likelihood of having a durable response with single agent immune checkpoint blockade. And because we're not great at that, and combination therapy has become so effective, that's just a more straightforward strategy. But this patient has a couple of reasons why immunotherapy, monotherapy, is really a good idea clinically. One is that the comorbidities are felt to present risk with combination therapy. The second is that there is a biomarker that suggests that maybe this individual patient has a higher likelihood of benefiting from immunotherapy, monotherapy. We know that TMB, tumor mutational burden, is associated with response to immune checkpoint blockade. That TMB cutoff has been argued, and there's discussions about whether or not there should be different cut points based on different tumor types. But the cutoff of 10 for a high TMB, commonly used, that has been associated with better outcomes in urothelial cancer specifically, and that's the cut point that was used in the tumor agnostic approval for pembrolizumab. So it makes a lot of sense to try pembrolizumab in this patient. This patient experienced an immune-related side effect. We know that there is some correlation. It's not absolute, but there's some correlation between immune-related adverse events and benefit from treatment. And this patient goes on to have quite a durable benefit from single-agent immune checkpoint blockade. And really, these are some of the happiest patients, I would say, in our clinic, because immune checkpoint blockade, when it works, it really can work quite well, and it can be tolerated really quite well.
I mean, I was kind of shocked to see this case. Have you seen patients like this, particularly with a TMB of 14, PD-1, CPS of 5, MS stable?
I absolutely have. I have a subset of individuals in my practice who have been on immune checkpoint blockade now for years, tolerating treatment without major side effects, having durable disease control.
And, you know, we've heard this story from the beginning with the checkpoint inhibitors, people who have an adverse event and have the IO stopped, which is what happened here, and then just remain in remission. She also brings up this issue of cell-free DNA. You see that throughout oncology. Maybe, I guess it would just be prognostic at this point, although if, for people who are continuing, if she hadn't had an adverse event, maybe she'd be on the Pembro. Do you think that cell-free DNA potentially plays any role in these types of cases?
So we know that there's a role for MRD testing using tumor-informed approaches in patients receiving IO therapy for solid tumors in general. It does seem to track with prognosis, and this is a situation where theoretically it could be particularly helpful, especially if a patient had detectable ctDNA initially and then that clears and there's a decision to stop treatment and monitor. One might want to continue following that biomarker to determine if there's going to be early evidence of progression such that treatment decision-making could be made in a timely fashion.
If she had not had this pneumonitis and, you know, but was continuing on therapy without any issues, I mean, you can always discuss it with the patient, but generally speaking, what do you recommend in terms of how long to treat?
So I have the discussion about how long to treat probably once a week in my clinics these days, and it's a really difficult discussion to have and a really difficult decision for individuals, particularly those who have durable control of metastatic disease in the absence of severe side effects. The trials did this in a variable way early on, capping at 1 year, capping at 2 years, not capping at all treatment until progression. And I find that most of my patients, when asked for regarding their preference, prefer to stay on treatment rather than stop treatment. There's a subset who feel pretty strongly about stopping treatment. And I think at 2 years with a CR, quite reasonable to do that based on the data that we have. There was a cooperative group trial that was attempting to answer this question because it is such an important question. And unfortunately, it was proved that randomization was not feasible to continue versus stopping. That trial couldn't enroll enough patients. And I think that tells us something about patient preferences in this setting.
So another issue here, and this comes up in breast cancer a lot in terms of with the drug TDXD, which of course is also used in many other cancers, including urothelial bladder cancer, which is whether to rechallenge patients who have pneumonitis. Now here we're talking about autoimmune pneumonitis. This lady sounds like she had grade one. She was asymptomatic. She had patchy findings and you know, again, with TDXD, they rechallenge people as grade one. How do you approach the issue of rechallenge for pneumonitis and other autoimmune conditions? How do you decide whether to try it or not?
So it depends a little bit on the grade, like you stated, and it depends a little bit on the context. In a patient who had, and it depends on the specific organ system involved as well and what the stakes are in terms of that getting worse. And that's why the treatment guidelines are really important, but they need to be individualized. Someone with bad COPD who has grade one pneumonitis, you might not want to take the chance that that's going to get worse as opposed to another individual who doesn't have that comorbidity. So if you look at the guidelines, grade one pneumonitis that resolves, patients can be rechallenged with immune checkpoint blockade. I think in this setting, a patient with comorbidities who has a complete or near complete response to treatment, really it becomes an issue of risk versus benefit. So quite reasonable not to restart in this setting, although strictly speaking for grade one pneumonitis, one can rechallenge.
The next case is presented by Dr. Onari.
This is a 71-year-old gentleman who was initially diagnosed with muscle-invasive bladder cancer, who was felt to have localized disease. Due to a new diagnosis of heart failure, there were some delays in him ultimately starting treatment. A restaging scan then revealed metastatic disease, and he was started on platinum-based chemotherapy, followed by immunotherapy maintenance, and upon progression, underwent treatment with single-agent enfortumab vedotin. Due to his baseline diabetic neuropathy, we opted to do a 21-day cycle with treatment on day one, day eight. By cycle three, when I saw him back in the office, he had slight increase in neuropathy of his hands that didn't affect his fine motor movements or any of his activities of daily living, but the decision was made to decrease the dose to 1 mg/kg. Cycle three, day eight was then held due to a slight increase again in neuropathy. While he's had a history of diabetic neuropathy, he had never been started on any medication for this, so we initiated gabapentin. He had improvement in his neuropathy with gabapentin. His gait instability improved, although he noted the hand neuropathy was slightly worse. Given stable disease, we opted to dose reduce further to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram. The following week, when he presented for day 8, his blood glucose was 275, so the decision was made to hold enfortumab vedotin. He then came back for cycle 5. At this point, despite holding day 8 for the last two cycles and dose reducing to 0.75 milligrams per kilogram, he had worsening neuropathy in his hands with difficulty buttoning a shirt and dropping utensils occasionally. His gait instability also worsened despite gabapentin. He admitted to not taking his diabetic medications regularly. At that point, the decision was made to discontinue enfortumab vedotin and go on a treatment break. How do you manage adverse effects associated with enfortumab vedotin, such as neuropathy and hyperglycemia? Another question that I pose is, what treatment would you use next in a patient who received platinum chemotherapy followed by immunotherapy maintenance and enfortumab vedotin?
What would you be thinking about if he had good performance status?
So he actually has HER2 positive disease.
Wow.
My only issue is his EF has been stable around 25 to 30% with medical management. So I'd have to work with one of our cardio-oncologists to really get a sense of, is trastuzumab deruxtecan a safe option for him? Because ideally, I'd love to use that for him. Another question for this case is, a patient with pre-existing diabetes, how do you screen prior to giving a medicine like enfortumab vedotin that has risk of hyperglycemia? Are you checking fasting blood glucoses, non-fasting blood glucoses? Are you following their hemoglobin A1Cs? If their hemoglobin A1Cs are elevated, are you referring them to endocrinology to then have further management before starting treatment?
This patient has several side effects from enfortumab vedotin, some of them more typical, some of them less typical. So hyperglycemia certainly can occur. It occurs in a smaller subset of patients, probably about 5 to 10%. There were exclusion criteria for the clinical trials with enfortumab vedotin that if the A1C was greater than 8%, patients weren't eligible for study. And so we do check A1C, and it's important to think about those patients who really have poor glucose control to make sure that they're plugged in with an endocrinologist before starting treatment. And really, that would apply for anyone with diabetes, but particularly for those patients with A1Cs in the 7 to 8 range. And then greater than 8, that's when you're really starting to think about risk versus benefit. Management is really just good diabetes control. And so sometimes medications need to be adjusted. Continuous glucose monitoring really has made this a little bit more streamlined in terms of being able to communicate in real time with endocrinologists and make adjustments. There are hold parameters on the package insert for enfortumab vedotin. So if on the day of treatment, glucose is 250 or greater, treatment should be held. And of course, that's what was done in this patient. Neuropathy, a more common side effect and oftentimes a treatment-limiting side effect. The management of neuropathy, you know, there are some nice guidelines in the package insert for enfortumab vedotin, but neuropathy as per CTCAE grading is somewhat complicated because grade 1 neuropathy is asymptomatic and we don't have patients undergo other forms of testing commonly for neuropathy. So, you know, we really start to detect neuropathy oftentimes when it is grade 2 already. I think those the comments that were made in this slide, things that were all used to as oncologists using drugs that cause neuropathy, including drugs other than enfortumab vedotin. Those common questions about activities of daily living and IADLs, like can you button your buttons? Can you pick coins off up the table? I ask patients if they're having issues texting on their phone. Are they tripping at all? Do they have issues when the lights are off in the morning and they're walking to the bathroom? Do they stub their toes? Those are the sorts of red flags that we start to think about holding EV and then dose reductions. And that takes a little bit of experience with EV in terms of knowing when to start to hold back because neuropathy can creep up with this agent, and it can be mild, and then get more severe over a short period of time.
Is the neuropathy usually reversible? How long does it take to reverse? And what's your experience with gabapentin? It kind of seems like maybe it helped here. I'm not sure.
So gabapentin, from a symptom standpoint, particularly if the neuropathy is painful, if there are paresthesias, can be helpful, but of course doesn't address the underlying cause of the neuropathy. Neuropathy, if you look at the trials that have indicated reversibility, there is reversibility in many to most patients. However, the degree of reversibility in terms of complete resolution and the timing is highly variable. You know, anecdotally, we have patients who have neuropathy improve over weeks when it's not very bad when we hold treatment, and we have neuropathy that takes months to years, and there's still improvement, but doesn't completely disappear.
In a patient who has HER2 positive disease, how do you decide whether or not to go ahead with T-DXd as second line therapy? Are there some situations, you know, elderly patients, people with prior lung problems? How do you decide whether or not to move forward?
It's in part related to comorbidities. It's in part related to whether or not cisplatin versus carboplatin-based chemotherapy is being considered. And of course, as I noted, we don't know that one regimen is better than the other in this second-line metastatic setting after EV pembro, but we've tended to think that cisplatin-based chemotherapy is a little bit better than carboplatin-based chemotherapy in urothelial cancer. The response rate, now granted, very, very small sample size, but the response rate to trastuzumab deruxtecan in IHC 3+ metastatic urothelial cancer is 56%. That beats the response rate in most series with gemcarbo, even as first-line treatment. So based on that, and based on the fact that platinum-based chemotherapy in this setting is also a conjecture, we don't have prospective data, I feel quite comfortable with trastuzumab deruxtecan in this setting. But of course, we need more data. The approval based on the tumor agnostic study, those individual baskets were quite small, and the basket in the subset of patients with 3+ expression in urothelial cancer even smaller.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Rapid Clinical Case Review.